Hello, and welcome back to the Joint Venture Podcast, Inspiration Insights. This week, we are going over all of the latest deals and news from the European renewables space. Zach will be bringing us up to date on all that. Also on this episode, after touching on it last week, we'll be bringing you some of the industry reaction after the UK government announced 100 new exploratory oil and gas licences last week. Dilo is back to go over some of the implications of that decision and what industry experts are saying about it. Also on this episode, we're going to discuss some latest economic data coming from China. We've seen the first indications of what could be a deflationary period. We'll be discussing the implications for the global renewable market. But as usual, we will begin with the news. Zach, take it away.
So the first news story I'd like to highlight was an announcement from Utsira Wind, which are a consortium headed by Odenfell Ocean Wind and Source Galileo, who expanded to include Kansai, which is one of Japan's largest utilities, and Inca Investments, which is the investment arm of Inca Group, the largest IKEA retailer. The consortium is going to focus specifically on floating wind, which is going to bid into the Utsira Nord floating wind offshore tender in Norway, which is due to commence in September 2023. We were lucky enough to speak with Source Galileo on the expansion of the partnership, and they provided a bit more context to the expansion. They stated that the companies have entered a partnership to develop floating wind farms using Odenfell Ocean Wind's technology. The combination of cooperation, local knowledge, technological innovation, strong capital, international expertise means that they will deliver strongly on all criteria of Utsira Nord tender. So that's kind of the reason behind the expansion. They want to bring in more expertise throughout the market coming from both Japan and Sweden. Looking specifically at the Norwegian market, they stated that floating offshore wind is a developing technology where Norway is already a pioneer. Norway was first in the world to launch floating wind offshore turbines in 2009, and since then, several countries have joined the development, but with the Utsira Nord tender, Norway is poised to regain the lead. The objective of the tender is to demonstrate Norwegian offshore wind technology for a desire to export to the rest of the world. And in this way, they will be able to fulfill the Norwegian government's desire to become one of the world's foremost offshore wind nations and make a good living from the export of technology, expertise, experience, looking at the future.
We've got some more news from the UK solar side.
Yeah, so UK-based renewable energy and battery storage developer Luminous Energy hit financial close on a 28.5 megawatt solar project called Bracken Ash Solar Farm, located near Norwich in Norfolk. The facility is expected to generate its first power in the summer of 2024, and actually signifies Luminous Energy's transition to an independent power producer. We were also able to garner some significant extra detail on the deal, speaking directly to Guy Laverack, who is the Chief Investment Officer at Luminous Energy. We learned that the project has planning consent for a co-located battery, with consideration for that given under Phase 2 of the project. This fits into more general pattern for Luminous Energy, where co-location is a feature in their long-term development pipeline. In addition, we learned that the project was funded for a mixture of non-recourse senior debt from Novona Business Finance and equity held directly on the Luminous Energy balance sheet. The financing represents a relatively new project finance solution for the energy and infrastructure space, with Guy Laverack stating, "We're particularly pleased to proceed to financial close in an efficient manner with all legal and technical due diligence completed within 10 weeks. The interest in the East Anglia market in particular was driven by several factors. Guy Laverack stated, "There's quite a lot of onshore wind development in Norwich, as well as offshore wind off the coast, so solar helps balance this out. In Bracken Ash Solar Wind Farm, we found a willing and passionate partner in terms of our landowner, who has been very patient whilst the project moved through its various phases of development." Moving on, we have a report from Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, who inked an agreement with Ignitis for its New Markets Fund to collaborate exclusively on offshore wind opportunities in Estonia and Latvia. CIP and Ignitis will support efforts to develop an onshore wind industry in the two countries, focusing on establishing a local knowledge hub and workforce to boost employment opportunities in the growing sector. The agreement actually follows up on CIP's announcement of its first close of its fifth flagship fund, Copenhagen Infrastructure 5, at 5.6 billion euros in capital commitments received, with the fund target size of 12 billion. And finally, Crédit Agricole Assurances signed an agreement with Innergex Renewable Energy to acquire 30% minority interest in Innergex's portfolio in France. The investment represents a €128 million investment, subject to customary closing adjustments. The portfolio includes 17 operating assets, totaling 324 megawatts of wind energy and 9 megawatts of storage capacity, as well as a large portfolio of projects at various stages of development. The enterprise value of Innergex France is estimated at €710.1 million, including €22.2 million of cash in hand. Innergex's team will continue to lead the management of the entire value chain from development to construction and operation, with the transaction expected to close at the second half of 2023.
So this is a really substantial move in the French market. Can you put that in some context for us?
Sure. So as we all know, the French energy market is very much dominated by their 56 nuclear reactors, which makes up, I believe, two-thirds of France's electricity. But however, renewable energy is taking a growing share in the country's energy mix, representing a target of 25.3% of France's gross energy final consumption for 2022. French government support as well has increased substantially, with a 25% uptick, with a commitment of €6 billion in 2021. The French renewable market is very diverse, covering 10 different subsectors. So there is still a lot to be done within the French renewable market, with solar and wind, with a lot of room to grow. And finally, I'd like to just highlight a few more long-form pieces we have on the website. Firstly, we had a Q&A with Quinbrook Infrastructure Partners. We spoke to David Scaisbrook, co-founder and managing partner of Quinbrook Infrastructure Partners, about the company's diverse investment portfolio, approach to risk, and view to the future. The week before, we were able to speak to DIF Capital Partners, speaking directly with Allard Rigis, partner and chief investment officer at DIF, about why solar is not a vanilla investment, as many in the industry believe, and how the company maximizes returns from its solar projects.
Yes, you can find all of the Q&As that we have done recently on the website, going back many, many months. And also, if you were listening last week, we had a long discussion about carbon capture and storage, and Zach here was the one who wrote that feature. So can you perhaps summarize what the points that we missed there, Zach?
Yeah, unfortunately, I was not invited to the podcast last week, despite them talking exactly about what I wrote about. I don't know why. It must have been a vendetta against me from Oliver. But I wrote about CCUS in a piece titled CCUS, a Game-Changing Technology or Greenwashing, to consider how it can be deployed, what sectors are best suited to its integration in the long term, in addition to what challenges it has improving its scalability and efficiency. Three main points that came out of the piece was that CCUS will have to emerge with a key technology to decarbonize hard to abate sectors such as cement, iron and steel, but still faces skepticism over scalability and efficiency, with concerns raised about potential greenwashing of legacy oil and gas activities, with those companies the major investors. In addition, we found that the CCUS sector has experienced significant growth investment over the last couple of years, with over 500 pipeline projects driven by commitments from the US and UK governments, leading to proponents to believe that the technology can overcome challenges with time and investment and contribute to long-term emissions reductions. Finally, we explored the role that it will play in the fledgling hydrogen economy, particularly in facilitating blue hydrogen projects by capturing and sequestering emissions from natural gas. However, this effectiveness depends on keeping with other carbon abatement strategies like green hydrogen and recycling scrap steel.
Thank you very much, Zach. And to be clear, you're welcome on the podcast anytime you like.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
So, Oliver, we've seen some new economic data coming out of China. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, please?
Certainly, Zach. This week, we have seen some not particularly positive economic news coming out of China, particularly around deflationary concerns. The world's second largest economy, China's economic health is integral to all global markets, and recent indicators are somewhat troubling. China has reported in July that its retail price index fell to 0.3%, negative on a year-on-year basis, meaning that the Chinese economy has now officially entered deflation. This is the first period of deflation since the end of extreme pandemic measures in early 2021, and Perhaps even more concerning is that the producer price index, an indicator of factory outputs and prices in China, has dropped a stark 4.4%. Now, the cause of this is obviously still being debated. The pandemic's obviously having a massive impact in China and that part of the world, with the zero COVID policy having a dampening effect on China's factory outputs. However, there's also concerns around consumer spending, the cornerstone of a healthy economy, which hasn't rebounded within China as was expected after the pandemic. This is in contrast to other major economies, of course, as China has sidestepped the global inflationary trend, where other nations have embarked on broad stimulus measures during the pandemic. China maintaining the zero COVID policy stood in contrast to that. And while Beijing has started to implement some minor remedies to this, such as interest rate cuts and business tax incentives, a large-scale stimulus still remains absent. The divergence in policy, while initially seen as prudent by many Western observers, now is being looked at a bit more skeptically in retrospect.
So how does this economic data compare to China's targets for its own economy?
So not favourably. The year-to-date average for the consumer price inflation stands at 0.5%, which falls significantly short of the government's target of 3%. China is famous for its incredibly quick GDP growth, although this year, in 2023, it set a target of GDP growth for 5%, which is actually the lowest target it set in decades, and it's not clear that it's even going to reach that goal. Yeah, so between quarters one and two, economic growth was sluggish at just 0.8%, which, yeah, again, falls very short of that 5% target. And it would indicate that the Chinese economy is not, in fact, on track to meet its government-given targets. This has been chalked up to a sharp decline in both exports and imports. Exports have declined 14.5%, whereas imports have declined 12.4% year on year.
So, Oliver, what are the wider implications for the world economy when it comes to the renewable energy sector?
So China has, of course, a pivotal role in the renewable energy supply chain. We covered on this podcast before the role that it plays in the mining and processing of rare earth, the production of wind turbines, photovoltaics. So there's going to be a lot of people looking at this data very concerned. And the country's economic health is, of course, paramount to many global renewable projects. When it comes to supply chain, a contracting manufacturing sector in China, which has been consistently declining now for the past 4 months, could lead to supply chain shortages, which could drive up costs in the wider renewable sector, a problem which is already causing disruption to projects, particularly in Europe. Developers have been able to rely on low-priced produce from China, perhaps where European prices have been pushing up. But if there is more disruption to the supply chains, then this could indicate that there could be a deeper problem there. Of course, with raw materials, there's also been not great news with prolonged negative territory for producer prices, which have been on a downward trend for 10 consecutive months and could translate to a drop in the commodity prices of raw materials. While this could be beneficial in the short term for renewable energy manufacturers outside China, it will also probably lead to a decreasing demand for Chinese exports, which could stall, as I say, renewable projects globally.
I guess this is actually quite a good thing, then. It might provide a sort of additional impetus for European and American actors in particular that have been trying to diversify away, I guess, or alongside Chinese supply chains, particularly when it comes to those critical components, maybe critical minerals, etc.
This is true. And I think that, Dila, you wrote a piece about the critical role of minerals and supply chains and China's role in that not long ago. And I think that one of the things that you highlighted there, if I remember, was the onshoring of supply chains from European and American developers, and how a lot of developers are particularly encouraged by policy moves like the IRA in America, are moving their supply chains away from China and trying to move those much more into the US and Europe and non-aligned countries, if I can use that expression. Yes, I think that might be, in fact, part of the problem for the Chinese economy. As supply chains are moving away, people are trying to shorten supply chains and lessen the demand in the Chinese economy. That is one of the key factors, I think, which is driving this deflationary pressure, a lack of demand for Chinese industrial goods.
Yes, I think that's certainly part of the picture. Do I think it's important to remember China is currently playing such an enormous role within the supply chain? I don't think they're anywhere near moving away from the dependence there is on China at the moment. I think it's important to remember this is a trend at the moment, and certainly a trend that there's Western actors in particular have been trying to intensify over the last few months and certainly moving ahead. I think one of the comments I remember the most from that article when I spoke to some industry experts was that it is important to potentially diversify alongside Chinese supply chains, and it is important that they're not left behind, because this is at the end of the day, this is a global effort that needs to be undertaken, and China is not an actor we can afford to leave behind in any way.
I think you're right, Dila, and the point you made about parallel supply chains is very crucial here, as you know, companies are increasingly finding themselves in need of diversifying their supply chains to deal with potential disruption. I think it goes to show that there's a certain detangling that the US and China are currently undergoing, trying to move their economies further away from each other after a long period of heavy reliance. And just underscoring this, today we've seen the story of Joe Biden moving to restrict US-Chinese investment, with the White House issuing an executive order which limits US investments in Chinese technology, including semiconductors, quantum computing, and artificial intelligence. So yes, this not good news for China. There could be opportunities here, of course, but a weakened Chinese consumer base is also likely to lead to a decrease in energy consumption, or at least a decrease in the rate of energy consumption growth in China, which is obviously a huge issue for net zero goals worldwide, which might have knock-on effects on China's domestic and international renewable energy markets if there is that decrease. So there's, you know, risks here as well as potential upsides for players looking from the outside, but I would caution against people reading too far into this. Again, we are basing this off economic data reported from China just in the most recent month. This is not necessarily the start of a spiral for the Chinese economy, but there are certainly questions being asked around that, and the confidence in the Chinese market is not what it once was. So, as mentioned at the top of the show, the oil and gas licenses issued by UK government last week have proved incredibly controversial, and Dila has been taking the temperature of the market for us. Dila, can you bring us up to date, first of all, just on what we know of the facts so far?
Yes, certainly. The temperature, as you say, is quite high. Yes, so this all began when the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak recently visited a gas plant in Scotland, and then this reignited quite the global attention as he reaffirmed support for some upcoming oil and gas exploration licenses in the North Sea. This obviously generated quite the debate, particularly in light of negative news, let's say, climate-wise, with rising ocean temperatures and somewhat recently the Climate Change Committee's report expressing their confidence in the UK's efforts towards achieving its climate targets is actually somewhat reduced. It's also important to note here that this goes against advice that has been issued by the International Energy Agency after the UK itself commissioned a report that recommended that new oil and gas field developments should be stopped by 2021 in order to achieve global net zero targets by 2050 and indeed limit those temperature rises. Sunak himself has actually argued that the new fuels will bolster energy security, particularly amidst the ongoing tensions with obviously Russia being removed from the energy supply picture and the following sanctions. He in fact said that the UK will extract as much oil and gas from the North Sea as possible.
That certainly doesn't sound like the actions of a net zero conscious energy policy. So what is the sort of energy security argument for this new round of granting licenses?
Yes. So, I mean, overall, the critics of this will argue that the prioritization should lie with renewable energy sources. The investment should go towards that. Others will say that oil and gas is going to continue its relevance within the energy security in the UK. However, the critical side of things will also point out that this is bordering on energy security washing, that suggests that these new licenses will promote energy security even though it's not really justified, particularly in the face of more secure renewable alternatives. This is also interesting when we look at some of the development timelines of these licenses. The Climate Change Committee again had issued a letter to Kwasi Kwarteng in about 2 years ago, I think, saying it can take about 28 years for some of these production lines to come online. So the effects of the resulting sort of additional supply would not even be felt for a few decades if that's the case. I think the shortest amount of time I've seen is 5 years, but even that would only result in somewhat marginal yields because the North Sea itself is actually in a state of managed decline, which the North Sea Transition Authority itself has confirmed. So whatever is invested and however long it will take, it will actually not even result in a massive increase of energy security, especially because most of the large majority of that energy will be exported anyway.
Yes, I think there's been the government certainly had to fight critics not only from outside on this one, but also it's been dealing with its own previous statements. The government's been finding it hard to sort of argue on the price point, but the energy security is what they're sort of focusing on then, by the sounds of what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. I mean, on the other side, the proponents of this will say that they're, because of the uncertain nature of these subsurface explorations, the complexity of it, they have seen shorter development times. On the other side, they will also say that even a few weeks would actually be great to have in the face of energy cuts.
So that's a few weeks of potential energy usage in the event of outages or disruption to other parts of the energy supply chain.
Yes, that's right. So it's just, so the supporters would say when supply disruptions occur, and they would provide a critical buffer during emergencies.
So as you mentioned there that there is a managed decline period in the production in the North Sea. If there's going to be a lot more development of production and more assets put out to try and increase the production while it's on a declining trajectory, does that not risk there being a significant amount of stranded assets towards the end of the lives of these projects?
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's part of a major concern of the industry, actually. So the investment rationale is definitely further complicated by the risks of these stranded assets. And it raises concerns about whether or not the investment in these new projects will become economically unviable due to changing energy landscapes and policies. Regardless of climate impacts and emissions, it becomes this commercial question whether or not it is prudent for investors to actually channel these funds into new projects if there's a looming risk of these becoming unviable. And these are substantial financial commitments that are also closely linked to the investment sentiment vested within the United Kingdom that can also have significant effects on its investment environment.
So there's been a lot of talk about the UK's perception of a leadership position within the renewable sector, with its net zero goals, with a legal commitment to net zero by 2050, for example, and the leading position that the UK has taken in the offshore wind sector. But with these announcements, there's been some backsliding, it would seem, from the top brass on this.
Yes, exactly. So that's been sort of my view on this, that there's sort of this, as you say, backsliding in climate commitments, because the backing for these new licenses has obviously led to doubts about the UK's overall commitment to a net zero future overall and also its position as a leader. And some will also say that the UK is almost beginning to undermine itself and its commitments, particularly when you compare it to positive developments that have been introduced to the US with the Inflation Reduction Act, providing a great impetus towards investments in renewable energy sources, as well as in the EU. Yes, of course, there are some inconsistencies sometimes, but the overall direction is definitely there and discernible. So this lack of a coherent message in the UK will pose significant challenges. And it also raises questions about the UK's industrial competitiveness and its position as a leader on the global stage in terms of energy and climate policies. However, again, supporters of this will highlight that maybe this is a time where the UK can assume a new leadership role in which it doesn't necessarily equate net zero to the complete removal of oil and gas, and instead can show and demonstrate how energy efficient some of these projects can be, and maybe can distinguish itself by setting a benchmark for efficient and low emission extraction methods.
I suppose there's very different implications if you're a government and your environmental credibility compared to if you're a company. On the Inspiration website this week, we have a piece which is focusing on the links between ESG goals and particularly environmental credibility and how that has an effect on companies' cash flow and evaluations. Thrust of that article, of course, being that companies that neglect ESG goals are seeing that that could eat into their valuations, their cash flow, and just make their business appear much less appealing to ESG conscious investors. However, I think when you're a government, the consequences of not following your own environmental policy are different. You can perhaps get away with a lot more because you don't have that kind of oversight from investors, but you do have oversight from, you know, the electorate. So if country doesn't think that environmental goals are that important, then maybe it makes sense if you're a government to make these moves. But I suspect that these oil and gas licenses are not going to be particularly popular, but that, I suppose that's something that we'll find out in the coming years.
I guess the investors will have something to say about it if you're going back and forth about commitments, or at least in your appearance about how strongly you back certain policies and your own commitments. At the very least, I think the UK has managed to create a massive PR problem for itself. Even if this isn't going to be about energy security, etc., it definitely didn't show green warriorism some of the world is portraying and displaying. So in that sense, I think it has been backsliding.
Could we compare this to the move a couple of years ago when the US removed itself from the Paris Agreement? Is it that level of movement? I might be slightly exaggerating things, but I suppose it does go to show that the US now is seen, of course, as a central part of the renewable economy with the Inflation Reduction Act, of course, pushing that forward. So I guess governments can swing much more than investors who want stability in these sort of policies can would prefer.
Yes, I think, I mean, I guess in a similar way, but then it's important to see, yes, there's commitment, but is the action following as well? And I think in some terms, the UK is falling behind on those commitments as well. So, yes, the US pulling out of it under the Trump administration, yes, it was shocking, but then I guess eventually they came back with a...
with gusto.
Exactly, with some gusto. And, you know, if the UK doesn't do that, I think it is comparable and much worse, in fact, than Trump just pulling out of that. There's a lot more legally binding commitments I think the UK has to worry about and is currently also not on track to achieve.
Thank you very much, Dila.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And that is it for this week. Thank you so much to our contributors this week. Thank you so much, Zach.
Thank you, Oliver.
Thank you for the insights, Dila.
Thanks for having me.
I have been Oliver, and this has been the Joint Venture Podcast. We'll be back again next week with more news and analysis from the global renewable sector. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.